supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Larry Krasner, Philadelphia's progressive incoming district attorney, intends to shake up the office when he's sworn in January 2nd. Krasner just announced his transition team, which includes current and former politicians, as well as members of the legal and business communities. The transition was already evident at Krasner's Center City office this afternoon, where boxes were stacked along the walls and where I talked with him about his plans as DA.
Just out is the roster of your transition team. It speaks to a broad range of political and business and civil rights community interests. What was your goal in trying to assemble this group, and how will they get you to the starting line?
My goal was to assemble a group of people who have been incredibly effective and who don't necessarily agree with me.
Ron Castile, a Republican for one.
Well, Ron Castile is in fact a Republican, and I expect he won't agree with me on everything, but I think he will agree with me on some things. Yeah, I mean, we have a really interesting and diverse group of people who represent different communities, and I define communities very broadly. There are business people here. There are people from elected office. We have one of the icons of progressive prosecution from the 1980s on this list in Elizabeth Holtzman. We have an ex-police commissioner in Sylvester Johnson. We have someone who was the president of Women Organized Against Rape and someone else who has been a leader in the victims' rights community. We have all kinds of great people here, and I'm looking forward very much to working with them and the many dozens of other volunteers who are involved.
So let's get to it. You cite Sylvester Johnson. To what extent can he be perhaps a liaison to the police community? And I'm referring specifically to that aspect of the force that is at odds with you, quite frankly, having started the hashtag NotMyDA.
Well, the nice thing about the internet is you can get one person to start a hashtag. And that's kind of what happened there. I think that Commissioner Johnson can do an awful lot to help. But to be honest with you, I didn't view him so much as a liaison. I viewed him and continue to view him more as a person of tremendous experience with some very wise insights on a point we share, which is that law enforcement has to be grassroots and has to involve a community that is engaged with the law enforcement officers who are charged with protecting them. I'm not too, you know, I know there's a lot of talk about police, but the fact is I've had a number of meetings and phone calls with Commissioner Ross. He and I get along really well, and I was endorsed by the African American Law Enforcement Officers Association, the Guardian Civic League. I just wasn't endorsed by the leadership of another organization that endorsed Donald Trump. And so I think the leadership of the FOP, who do not necessarily represent the views of the membership, were telling us a lot about their beliefs. They believe in Donald Trump. I don't. They have at times defended corruption and brutality in ways that I consider unacceptable. I don't. So we have a difference of opinion there, but that doesn't mean I don't respect them. And as you know, immediately after winning the general, the first thing that the head of the FOP said was that he was looking forward to working with me, and I'm looking forward to working with him as well.
Very specifically, how would you handle cases of repeat violent offenders who may be considered a danger to society?
So, you know, this is the core of the matter. The core of the matter is that 6% of criminals commit 60% of the serious crimes. They are the ones we always should have been going after very directly. In this core group, you have to be very aggressive about making sure that the public are kept safe by appropriately lengthy periods of incarceration.
When you take office, you have a list of priorities. What is job one on day one?
Job one on day one is to achieve culture change. To me, this is very analogous to tuning a car, because when I was a kid, I used to work on cars a lot. That was back when you could work on cars. But I used to tune cars, and I was actually pretty good at it. And the reality is, if you're going to go out and you're going to go racing, not that I ever did that, if you're going to go racing, then you got to tune the car first. And then you can go achieve some things. We need to go into that office, and we need to make sure that we have a core of leadership who share this vision, are incredibly hardworking and competent. And then we need to make sure that the policies are clear, so that we can move forward. If you don't change that culture by education, by having the right kind of leadership in place, by reorganizing that office properly, and you just continue to do things the way we have been doing things, we will not see the change that the voters require, and they require it. They voted in enormous numbers because they want it, and they're going to get what they want.
Larry Krasner, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Philadelphia District Attorney-elect Larry Krasner.
Controversy continues around changes to Delaware's Coastal Zone Act months after they were signed into law. WHYY's Zoe Reed has more from a tense public meeting last night.
The 1971 Coastal Zone Act was put in place to protect the Delaware Bay and the state shoreline from heavy industrial development. It grandfathered in existing businesses, but said if one shut down, only the exact same type of business could take its place. The new law creates a permitting process to redevelop 14 former industrial sites. Last night, Susan Mack asked for assurance the Regulatory Advisory Committee will represent the community and that regulations will be enforceable.
The changes to the Coastal Zone Act have really concerned a lot of people that it's going to open up to new heavy industry and bulk transfer facilities that could potentially pollute the environment and create health hazards. And the public hasn't been involved up to this point.
Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control Secretary Sean Garvin says he wants the regulations process to be as open as possible.
Ultimately, we'll have to put something together that works and makes sense, but even just tonight at this workshop, there's a number of very valuable things for us to consider to make sure that what I don't want to do is, as we are going through the process, continue to be fighting about the process. So we wanted to have these conversations up front to see if we could address as many of those things as we can.
The state has until October 2019 to create the new regulations. From the Delaware Desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
While Hollywood might make you think otherwise, under 1% of the 16,000 murder victims in the United States in 2015 died at the hands of a serial killer. That's why authorities didn't immediately recognize that one was preying on women in North Jersey last year. Though last February, authorities announced that they'd arrested Khalil Wheeler Weaver for three murders, as well as a kidnapping and sexual assault in which a fourth victim survived. They say a 19-year-old Philadelphia woman was Wheeler Weaver's first victim. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo talked with her family.
When Robin West first disappeared last fall, her family didn't immediately panic. Although she'd had a troubled childhood, she was a grown woman about to celebrate her 20th birthday. Still, after a week, they reported her missing. After 2 weeks,
her mom called me and said, oh, they found Robin.
That's Robin's father, Leroy West.
I immediately got excited. I said, well, let's put some gas in the car. Let's go get her. And she said, no, they found her body.
Investigators would soon tell Robin's parents that she had been working in the sex industry and that she was the first of four victims of a serial killer. Her cousin, Zena Mason, says the news was almost too much to bear.
It's just hard because she was such a good person. She was really, really loving, and that's a problem in this world because people take advantage of that. And just too trusting. Too trusting. And it's just sad, but it's a good thing that she can't get hurt anymore.
The man accused of killing Robin, Wheeler Weaver, seemed like a surprising candidate for a serial killer. He comes from a family of cops, and he worked as a grocery store security guard. Robin's father is in law enforcement, too. He's a police officer at Frankfort High School. He also recently became a minister. But while he counsels his congregation to forgive, he finds that advice hard to follow himself.
Been in the church all my life, love the Lord. I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet because you took something from me that was very precious. And I'm just not there. And, you know, I'll never see her graduate. I'll never see her walk down the aisle. I'll never see her have a child. It's gone. The only thing I have is memories and a cross that I wear on my neck with her ashes in it. That's all I got.
The family still has lots of questions, like whether Robin went willingly with Wheeler Weaver or if he snatched her. They won't get answers for a while. Wheeler Weaver's trial isn't expected until at least fall of 2018. In the meantime, Robin's mother, Anita Mason, likes to play a Facebook video Robin recorded of herself singing a hymn. Robin was deeply troubled. As a teenager, she struggled in school and never graduated high school. She sometimes ran away, and her family suspects she had undiagnosed mental health problems. But Robin always returned to the church, where she often sang in the choir. And it's the church that brings Mason comfort now, as she awaits justice for her daughter.
And I asked God just to keep and protect Robin. And in that keeping and protecting her, part of it was calling her home. So that's where I'm at peace.
Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
Massage Envy, the largest chain of massage franchises in the country and indeed the world, trades on trustworthy services at reasonable prices. Don't tell that to the more than 180 customers who instead allege they were sexually assaulted, including 9 patrons at the Massage Envy in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Katie Baker investigated this matter as a reporter for BuzzFeed News and joins me now live on the line. Katie, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Katie, take us to Westchester, Pennsylvania. What is being alleged?
So the Massage Envy Spa in Westchester is one of nearly 1,200 Massage Envy spas across the country. And a few years ago, a massage therapist pled guilty to sexually molesting 9 former clients of his there. A number of those women filed a civil suit against Massage Envy, saying that the national franchise and the individual spa both mishandled their complaints and should have known that the massage therapist was sexually assaulting women. And one of those women, Susan Ingram, is scheduled to go to trial against Massage Envy Franchising this January.
When Susan Ingram returned home, she did call the facility. To what end?
Susan Ingram has said, both in her criminal court case and in her lawsuit, that she called the spa immediately after getting home, and she said that she had been sexually assaulted, and she asked the manager on the phone to interrupt the massage therapist session with a client, and the manager would not. She asked to be connected to the owner, and the manager would not, and so she waited for half an hour or so to hear back, and nothing happened, so she called the police. And that's when, within an hour or so, the massage therapist confessed.
On what basis is it alleged that Massage Envy should have known about the perpetrator?
According to the civil lawsuit, 2 women complained about the massage therapist, James Dieter, before Susan Ingram had her massage in May 2015. And according to court filings, Massage Envy corporate knew about one of these complaints, but they did not fire him. They did not call the police. It seems that what happened is they decided that the complaint wasn't credible, in part because the woman didn't want to come in back to the spa and discuss what happened in person.
Katie, you said earlier that Massage Envy has some 1,200 franchises, and is it the specific language around franchise law upon which they're basing their defense?
Yes. So although Massage Envy Franchising says it leads the industry when it comes to sexual assault policies, it also argues in court filings that as a franchisor that sells franchise agreements rather than employs individual massage therapists, it shouldn't be liable in client sexual assault lawsuits. And oftentimes their cases are settled under strict confidentiality clauses, so it's difficult to know exactly what happens, but in general, they say, we're not liable. We can't, as a franchisor, do that much in the day-to-day operations of our spas.
That's their contention. What does Susan Ingram's attorney allege?
Susan Ingram and the other women who have brought lawsuits against Massage Envy spas often argue in their lawsuits that despite the company's claims that it doesn't play a role in investigations of inappropriate conduct, it does dictate the way they are conducted and followed and oversees their progress. And the company has an automated reporting tool where every time a complaint of inappropriate conduct is made to a spa, the spa has to immediately turn over a report to corporate. They get trained in the guidelines and policies from corporate. They are required to investigate in the first place from corporate. So it's going to be up to a jury to decide for the first time if Susan Ingram's case does, in fact, go to court in January.
Regardless of their decision, Ingram is also working with Representative Pat Meehan.
Yes. Last year, she helped him introduce bipartisan federal legislation, and it would require owners and employees of massage spas to report allegations of sexual assault to police. It would be up to the victim to decide whether to pursue charges, so the victim would still have agency in that decision. But Meehan said at the time that having to report the assault would help victims understand their rights and their resources, and the bill would also require owners to publicly display policies about preventing and responding to sexual assault.
Katie, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Katie Baker, investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News. The city of Reading has long felt out of place on the U.S. congressional map. It was once divided between two different congressional districts. Now it's in one district, but the city has been separated from its surrounding communities in Berks County, instead attached by a small sliver to rural Lancaster County. As part of our series on redistricting called Over the Line, Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports.
Reading Mayor Wally Scott, a Democrat, has focused during his first couple years in office on things he can change without relying on higher levels of government.
I don't have any reason to need them for anything. And if I did, I would hope that I don't have to go to a person who wants political power rather than public service.
Looking at Pennsylvania's congressional map, it's not surprising that's how he thinks. Reading is one of the very poorest cities in the nation, with a staggeringly high 40% poverty rate. And the largely Democratic city has been fused into the 16th district with largely Republican Lancaster County, in what seems to be part of a larger effort to advantage the GOP. So it's understandable why Scott might trust his energies better spent on things over which he has more direct control.
It's the Democrats that blame the Republicans for not getting bills through. And then it's the Republicans who blame the Democrats. Why are you worthwhile up there if you can't cross over and talk to somebody on behalf of human beings and forget about the political parties?
Reading is now part of the 16th district, which is represented by Republican Lloyd Smucker. Smucker does hold office hours every other week in Reading City Hall, right next to where Mayor Scott has his own office hours every Monday. On this particular morning, Scott has about 24 people waiting for him. That's four times as many visitors as the congressman's office generally gets over the course of an entire day. Today, one of the people waiting for Smucker is Reverend Evelyn Morrison.
How are you? Good to see you.
Morrison says the community ministers would meet quarterly with Smucker's predecessor, but that she hasn't seen the new congressman since his campaign. Morrison grew up in Reading, and now she is a fixture at meetings of city council and the local water authority, contributing in recent years to public pressure that led to a forensic audit of the authority and its executive director resigning.
Without the voice of the advocate,
yes,
all this stuff would have been under the rug. We have to participate. Yeah. You have to be engaged in order to understand what's happening.
Yeah. Morrison is called into the office by one of Smucker's staffers, but learns Smucker isn't here. To see him, she'll have to make an appointment. So she leaves without getting into what she came here to discuss. Her list included congressional redistricting, which will happen again after the 2020 census.
On the map, they literally looked at the census track and went block by block, you see, or at least area by area. And so that's one of the things. And then the whole issue about them wanting, when I say them, the older politicians that have been in position for a long time, wanting to maintain their status.
Morrison says she thinks gerrymandering has, among other things, contributed to discouraging younger adults from civic engagement in recent years. 26-year-old Troy Turner isn't one of those disenfranchised youth.
It's still important to be out there and doing whatever it takes, whether it's lobbying, whether it's like disrupting certain events, anything it takes to sort of basically not let them get away with things.
Turner is a field manager for Make the Road Pennsylvania, an advocacy group with an office a few blocks from City Hall. Turner, though, says he does see a lot of hopelessness, people thinking their votes don't count. They've experienced candidates they support who win and then abandon their promises. And then there's what happened during the last election, when the Democratic candidate garnered way more votes in the city of Reading, but lost the election in the 16th handily.
We canvassed the entire city of Reading, knocked on 55,000 doors, had record turnout in all the precincts we were active in. All our candidates that we were supported won by wide margins, and it still didn't make a difference as far as the district is concerned. We put all that effort, all that money, all those people into doing that, and in the big scheme, it didn't, or in just the election itself, I should say, it didn't make a difference.
The congressional maps were last redrawn while Smucker was a state senator. He says there might be ways to change the redistricting process that can make it better, but he doubts that taking it out of the hands of the legislature will make it apolitical, even with an independent commission.
Most people would want someone who's accountable to the people to make decisions that affect district lines. So, you know, I think you'll want elected officials to have at least some degree of control over the process.
As for the way the 16th district was drawn, Smucker says he was directly involved and that many factors came into play. And ultimately, he likes the diversity of the district he now represents and says he works to know it well. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.